Hi, everybody, and welcome to State of Murder. Before we get started, Amber and I wanted to give a little message to you guys since everything in the world right now is a little crazy. And as I'm sure all of you have seen internationally and here in the USA, there's a lot of protests going on right now over the death of George Floyd. And so we just wanted to say for George Floyd, for Breonna Taylor, for Philando Castile, for Ahmaud Arbery, for Sandra Bland, for Eric Garner, for the multitude of names that we could name here, we just wanted to start this week's episode with a moment of silence for them. So please join us for that. All right. Thank you guys. And now back to the show. Welcome to another episode of State of Murder. I'm your host, Selena Cooper.
And I'm Amber Ratzloff. Thank you for joining us. And this week we are in South Dakota, the Mount Rushmore state.
Yes. The thing I knew about the Dakotas.
The one thing that Selena knew about the Dakotas, that Mount Rushmore was there.
We are here now. And my story doesn't have anything to do with Mount Rushmore. So the one
thing. Mine doesn't either. So is not at all. I don't have any facts about Mount Rushmore. I'm not doing fun facts about Mount Rushmore.
So. Neither. We're trying to bring you something new because hopefully you knew that Mount Rushmore was in South Dakota too.
I've been to Mount Rushmore, so I know what it looks like. I'll post pictures of my trip for my 16th birthday. Happy sweet 16. My family went to South Dakota. Family trip. Woohoo. I was not excited at all. Every teenager's dream is to, we actually drove to Western Nebraska to Chadron, which is a national park. And then my only, like, I was miserable and I knew we were going up to South Dakota. And so I was like, okay, well, if we're going up to South Dakota, I'm a history person. And so I was like, we have to go to Deadwood. So we went to Deadwood, South Dakota, and Mount Rushmore. Mount Rushmore is not as exciting. I mean, I was 16. So, I mean, I wasn't really thrilled to be there, but it's a lot smaller than you think. And it's just not. I just wasn't that.
Way farther away than where
it's a lot further. Well, it's pretty far away. It's not too bad, but it's just not as awe-inspiring as I thought it was going to be. So I just kind of was like, eh. And I always thought really straight, like, I really just had an issue with like Native American land, even back then, Native American land being used to put presidents that took over their land. Here, let me deface your mountain and put our American presidents on it.
Yeah, let's put this poor white guy up on your land. So who is on Mount Rushmore? It's Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln?
It's George Washington, Lincoln.
Jefferson.
Is it Jefferson?
I think Jefferson's on there.
And Teddy Roosevelt.
I was like, is it one of the Roosevelts? It is, right?
Yeah, and Teddy Roosevelt. He was the president that started the national parks.
So. And the other three, they were just like, let's pick. The first
first president, Abraham Lincoln, is probably America's, I would say, I don't know, favorite president?
I would say he's pretty up there on my list.
Yeah, no, I'm down with Lincoln. I was trying to think if I would put somebody else on Mount Rushmore. Obama?
FDR? I love
Obama. FDR, I love sure. Sure, FDR. Okay.
Got it. Didn't he get us out of the Depression?
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
I'm fine with FDR.
Yeah. See, but the thing is, they started off with really big president heads. Thinking ahead that maybe we'd want to add more.
Add more, yeah.
So they're kind of out
of the beginning. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know, outside of those two, who else I would add.
Yeah, there's not any president where I'm like, oh, he needs to be on there.
Honestly. Does any president need to be on a big rock in a mountain?
I'm going to be honest.
I remember George Washington other ways. He's also on our money.
That's true. I don't think I can name every president of the United States.
No. If you can, please.
I'll be impressed.
If you have a cool song or some little like thing that helps you name them, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
That's awesome. No, I don't. I could make it, like, I can skip around, like.
Oh, yeah. But I don't think I could. I couldn't name 45.
No, that's cool. I can start kind of, I can hit the end, and I can hit the beginning.
The middle.
Random ones in the middle.
The, like, or like the 1820s to, like, the 1860s, not great. Like, the 1870s to the 1900s, not great.
Yeah, I know, sometimes I hear, like, names, like, in random things, and I'm like, that guy, we had a president named that, like.
There's a whole bunch of old white guys.
In the 1920s, we had a president named Harding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Warren G.
Arthur, didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Grover Cleveland, Fillmore, Pierce? Tyler, Harrison.
There's a couple Harrisons.
Yep.
I know there was one Harrison.
Pretty good. William Henry Harrison.
I remember he was only in office for like a few months, right? Because he got sick on his inauguration
day. And died. Uh-huh. See, worked way better than we thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
There's a couple Adams.
Where you'll watch us try to name things in U.S. history, presidents. Capitals.
Oh, yeah, see, I wouldn't be able to name all the capitals.
I used to be able to. And what school what grade is that, like third grade, fourth grade, you learn all the United States capitals or something? I remember that. I remember learning it in school and I knew.
I had a red pencil box that had all the capitals. It was red and then on the front was a picture of the United States and it had every capital on it when I was little. I was probably in the second or third grade.
So again, if you have cool tricks for naming long lists of three things, let us know because that'd be cool to hear.
Or just
international
stuff,
not to leave out our international listeners. If you have something cool, I'd love to know like the capitals of like Europe, I guess.
The one thing I learned in the 4 years of Spanish I took in high school was the Spanish-speaking countries and their capitals through a rap song.
What? Do you know it? Can you say it now?
I don't know if I could get all the way through it, but I could get through some of it. It's like,
okay.
Mexico, DF, Mexico, Guatemala, Guatemala, Tegucigalpa, Honduras, San Salvador, El Salvador, Managua, Nicaragua, San Jose, Costa Rica, Panama, Panama. Ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. And then it goes on.
I love it.
I learned that, 25 years ago?
And you still remember it, so props. That's awesome.
I know. The one thing I remember, because we all know Amber Spanish is no bueno. But no, that's my one trick. I used to know it all. So then I knew all the Spanish-speaking countries and their capitals better than I knew our states and their capitals. Gotta teach me through song. I'm telling you, I'll learn it.
Yeah. Well, at one point, because I knew that, I don't know if you ever watched the Animaniacs.
Yes, right? Yep.
Where Yakko did Yakko. The song. Yep. United States, Canada, Mexico, Canada, you can make up a roux. He goes through all of
them. I remember that. We're Animaniacs.
Sane to the max.
The max. We're getting off on just like random.
I know so many things.
I think it's because we're both really tired.
Probably. We'll cut out a lot of this. All right. So do you want to get started with your story for South Dakota this week?
Yeah, absolutely. So today my crime takes place in Pierre, South Dakota. Many people will probably pronounce it Pierre because that's the way it's spelled and how I would normally say it, but my dad corrected me today. So I'm going to take my dad would know. Pier, like Navy Pier, or we are walking off a pier. So it takes place in Pier, South Dakota, and I'm going to tell you guys about Brad and Tammy Rhea. Tammy was born and raised in Lander, Wyoming. Her father, Donald, remembers that she was the type of person who was always watching out for others. So in school, if somebody was being picked on, she would always try to take them under her wing and become the person's friend and watch out for them. She was also very athletic, so she actually got a college scholarship, and she played volleyball for college for 2 years. She was just pretty outgoing, very well-liked. Tammy was introduced to her husband, Brad, by her sisters. Her sister's name is Raquel. Well, she actually has two sisters, but Raquel is the sister that introduced her to Brad. Those two worked together at a local restaurant when they all lived in Billings, Montana. So I actually introduced my brother to his wife, too, so...
Nice.
Matchmakers. So Brad was the bartender there and Raquel was a waitress. Raquel remembers introducing them, and then it wasn't very long after they got together that they got married. Tammy shared with her sisters that her biggest plan was to first get married and then she wanted to have a little girl.
Hmm.
Raquel shared that Tammy was really an honest person, so she would always kind of tell you like it was and didn't always sugarcoat things. So you knew, like, if you asked her opinion or anything, she would always share it with you. Not long after Tammy and Brad got married, they did end up having the daughter that she had always dreamed about having, and they named her Haley. Tammy's sisters remember Brad being very, very attentive to Tammy, but almost a little overly attentive. So,
like, overprotective?
No, super or just clingy. Like, so, like, if she was in a room, he always had to be like sitting right next to her, always touching her. He didn't really let her go off on her own. Like when they would visit family, like they didn't, I don't have a sister. You don't have a sister either. But like what I imagine, I have like sort of sisters, you know, like really good friends that I view as sisters. But you know, that like girl time that you want to have and have girl talk, he just never really allowed that time. So the sisters would be sitting together.
Those are red flags.
Yeah. That's always, I'm like, whenever you read that or hear that or a friend tells you, I always am like, ooh, that's not great. But sometimes people really like that. Tammy didn't think it was that odd.
Okay.
She just thought he was being very attentive. Brad and Tammy lived in Billings for the first 14 years of their marriage. And then in 2004, Brad got offered a job to become a store manager at the Walmart in Pier, South Dakota. So, Selena and I are very big Walmart fans, so.
Target all the way.
Target all the way. So, so I was like, Walmart, ugh. That's what I always think when I
Brad.
Brad, what are you thinking? So they packed up all their belongings and moved the 10 hours away from all their friends and family so that Brad could become the manager. Their daughter Haley was not excited for the move. So she was 11, I think, about the time that they moved.
So you're at that age where you have like all your friends and you're about to go probably like finishing up elementary school and heading into middle school. That has to be hard.
Yeah, I remember my parents moving me. I was 12 when my parents moved me from Washington to Nebraska. Whereas, I mean, she's moving from one small town to another small town. Like, I moved from a big city to a small town, so it was super culture shock. But still, like, for a kid, I definitely can identify with Haley and being really upset, because moving for any kid is hard, making friends when you move, especially to a small town where a lot of times kids...
Everyone's known each other.
Oh, yeah, like, everybody has gone to school from kindergarten up. You're the odd man out. So I totally get it, Haley. Totally. That would have been very, very hard. It wasn't long after they got to Pier that Tammy actually got a part-time job at a Kmart store. During Christmas of 2005, Tammy went back to Lander to visit her family. Now, usually Brad would come with her, but this time he ended up staying behind, I believe, because he had to work. So, you know, Christmas time, any retail job.
Yeah, so lucky for her that she got out, too. I remember working holiday season at Target. Mm-hmm. You couldn't ask for any time off between Thanksgiving and, like, New Year's.
Yeah. You were done. Yeah, when I worked at Starbucks, and that was called blackout period, and so nobody could request any of that time off. So she was lucky enough, and Haley ended up going back to Lander to visit their family. During this break, Tammy would end up sitting down with her mother and her two sisters and shared that she was actually planning on leaving Brad.
Okay.
She shared that she wanted to leave him for years, but never had the courage to do it before. She had been a stay-at-home mom for a long time, so she hadn't been working, so I feel like she just didn't feel like she could care for her daughter and herself, so kind of like the financial security of splitting up. Mm-hmm. But this time, Tammy had it all planned out. She was getting a full-time job doing medical billing for a pharmacy. She was planning on staying in the house that they had bought, and that so she and Haley would live there and Brad would be moving out.
And they would stay in South Dakota, right? This
yeah, was the plan. Yes. So they were planning on staying in South Dakota, and she just knew she could make it on her own. Like, she was fine with that. Like, she was like, I can handle it. It's going to be fine. Okay. During that Christmas trip, Tammy also kept mentioning a new friend that she had made. She shared that she worked with him at Kmart, and his name was Brian, and that they were just really, really good friends.
Okay.
So the family was like, oh, okay, well, kind of glad you're making friends. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were worried about the divorce, but they're like, okay, she's got some plans. She can do this.
Yeah, so, sounds like she knows what she's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So Tammy went back to here after Christmas, and for years, every morning, she would call her mom as soon as she woke up, and they would have just a talk. So Tammy and her mom, Bonnie, had a very, very close relationship. They, you know, so they would just talk, sometimes only for a few minutes, sometimes up to an hour every single day. So around 7 o'clock every morning, Tammy would make that phone call. Except for on February 8th, 2006, Bonnie started getting really worried when she didn't get her normal morning phone call from Tammy. Mm-hmm. Bonnie tried calling Tammy, but Tammy didn't answer. Then when Tammy's sister Holly showed up at their mom's house that morning, Bonnie told her that she couldn't get a hold of Tammy, and they just both felt like something was wrong. It wasn't normal. We always talk about this, like, if things aren't normal, then they're not normal.
Like, yeah, and they would know, especially when people are on a routine like that.
Yeah, if you never miss a phone call and there's no reason, okay. Raquel ended up coming, and she also tried. So all three of them are trying to call Tammy, and there's still no answer. And so Raquel decides that she was going to call Tammy's work and see maybe if she was there, maybe she got called in or something. She ended up calling Tammy's work, and they told her that she wasn't there that day. So Raquel was like, she's like, okay.
Like, she wasn't scheduled that day, or like,
they didn't say.
Missed the shift. Okay.
Raquel mentioned that she had gotten paged. Like, she could hear over the phone, like, the speaker paging Tammy, but like, there was no response. So they just said that she wasn't there. So she didn't know if she was scheduled to work or what happened. Then Raquel shared that her next instinct was to contact this Brian person that Tammy had shared about over the Christmas break.
Okay.
Raquel stated that the family had never been really, really close to Brad, Tammy's husband. So they didn't even really consider calling him. Yeah. So,
plus, it's she just talked about divorcing him. So I don't know if you'd really want to reach out.
That's true. Yeah. I thought it was a little strange because they still live in the same house. And just because you told them. So I just thought that was weird. I was like, okay.
Yeah, but then if you think, I think in that moment, maybe you're going through, okay, let's try not to think of worst case scenarios. Maybe contacting him would be, last case. Let's check work and some other places.
But you're going to call a guy that you've never met, and you don't even know his last name. You just know it's a Brian that works at Kmart.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. That is weird. Unless they knew that he would be at work or something. I don't know.
It did sound like they knew a lot about him.
That is a little weird.
Yeah. I just thought it very interesting. So instead, Raquel knew that this coworker was a manager at Kmart and that he worked at the Kmart that Tammy worked at, and his name was Brian. Mm-hmm. So they called the store again and asked to speak to Brian this time. And when he came to the phone, Raquel asked him if he had seen Tammy. When he stated he hadn't, Raquel said that they weren't able to get a hold of her that morning. Brian was like, okay, well, maybe she started her new job. Let me call and see if she's there.
With not calling Brad, what if maybe they call Brian thinking that if this is her new friend, she hinted that it was kind of more romantic. So they think, well, we don't want to get her in trouble if she's with him when she's not supposed to be. Like, if you call out and say, oh, where is she? She didn't call. She didn't do this. Oh, well, she's supposed to be here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want to cast
her in trouble.
Horses can be messy, and you don't want to give him any ammunition because we don't know if he would fight for custody or anything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that.
True.
Into their mind. I don't know. Speculation.
So, yeah, speculation. So while Brian is calling, I guess, the job, Raquel decides that she's going to call the school that Haley's at and talk to Haley to see if Haley knows where her mom is. Mm-hmm. So Raquel talks to Haley, and Haley states that she hadn't seen her mother that morning either. Haley did mention at the time that her mom's purse and cell phone had been on the kitchen counter when she got up in the morning, but that her mom wasn't there.
Okay, that doesn't sound good.
That doesn't sound good, I know. So Brian, when he got off the phone with Raquel, he didn't just call Tammy's new job, which he did do, and she wasn't there either. He also ended up calling and reporting Tammy as a missing person with the police.
Okay, so maybe he knows something that they don't.
Okay, so during this 911 call, Brian shared that Tammy had been missing since 5 p.m. the night before, and that she was last seen wearing a black turtleneck. Brian then stated that he believed that foul play could be involved. And when the dispatcher asked why he thought that, Brian stated that he and Tammy had been having an affair and that Tammy's husband had found out about it.
Okay, why did he not tell her mom and sisters about that?
Yeah.
He apparently saw her. Well, I guess he didn't say that he hadn't seen her, right? He just said he didn't see her.
At work, yeah. So he hadn't seen her that morning, so he didn't know why she didn't call her mom. That probably confirmed
foul play for him is like, oh, now her mom's not even getting a hold of her.
Yeah, no. So there's definitely some questions. After Brian made that call to the police kind of were like, okay, this is weird. So they actually went to talk with Brad. According to the police, Brad appeared really surprised when they showed up at his work. However, he did go with the police to his home and gave them permission to search the home to look for her. Brad stated that, because they asked him, obviously, if he knew where Tammy was. So Brad stated that he had gotten home from work around 10 p.m. the night before and that his daughter Haley was already in bed asleep, that he did see Tammy pull up in her Dodge Durango and then get out of her car and get into another car that night. So that was around 11:30, he said.
So he saw her leave and he didn't question why she wasn't back the next morning or why her purse and phone were still there, because it doesn't sound like he knew that he was getting a divorce. Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
why would he not care that she hadn't come back after leaving with someone he seemed to not know
or recognize? Brad stated that after he saw her get into the car, he actually attempted to follow them in her car. So he got into her Durango. The police asked why he took her car, and he said that it was quicker and would be easier for him to follow them in. However, the car ended up breaking down. I know you have like some skepticism on your face, I see.
Yeah, I'm taking it all in.
Okay, take it all in. So he's at the side of the road and a cop car actually pulls up behind him. And you can actually see, if you want, like there's dash cam footage of.
Okay, so this really happened.
Yep. So Brad got questioned about what he was kind of doing. And Brad tells the cop that he didn't have his ID with him because he had quickly just popped out of the house to go to the store. The cop asked him what he wanted to do with the car. And Brad stated that he was hoping it would start again and then he was just going to take it home. The car did end up starting, and Brad stated that he went directly home and parked the Durango in the garage. As he's telling this to the cops, there's already some like, okay, red flags, because obviously what he told the cop the night before and what he was telling them now were totally two different stories, because he wasn't going to the store. He was following his wife, apparently in a car with some other person.
And what would be the point of lying? Why wouldn't you tell the cop, hey, my wife just got in the car with someone. I don't
know who
like,
it
even
is.
If you're trying to follow her because you're trying to catch her in something, why wouldn't you use the cop and be like, oh, I think somebody got her into their car. Like, I just want to make sure she's safe. So I'm following him. Can you help me?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you use the cop to your advantage in that situation? What's the point of lying unless you're hiding something?
Yeah, exactly. He's telling him all this, and he's like, go ahead and look and see if she's in the house or whatever. So the police go in to the house, and they end up going to the garage to see if Tammy's car is there, and it is. Her car is parked in the garage, just like Brad had said. But upon inspection, one of the detectives noticed that there was blood dripping from the running boards of the Durango. And he stated it was about a drop of blood every 10 seconds, still dripping. So not like it had been dripping and like there was blood, like
a puddle or something.
Yeah. No, still dripping. And then when he opened the back door, all he could smell was bleach. Oh. And you could see that somebody had wiped the car, swishes of like how you would clean up stuff.
The streak. Yeah.
Yeah. So like the streaks. So like hit something had been wiped away. The detectives knew the case from that point on probably wasn't a missing persons case anymore, but a homicide case, because they were just like, okay, this is not adding up to what we want.
Yeah.
They obviously took Brad to the police station to question him.
Yeah. So,
The first thing they asked is if he had run over an animal or something that night. Brad said he didn't. Brad kept saying, just acting like there was nothing wrong, that he didn't do anything wrong.
Did they tell him they found blood on the car?
Yes, they did. He just didn't know why it would be there.
Oh, I don't know. My garage is suddenly bleeding? How does that? Why would you not be more like, I don't know.
Yeah, and you were the last person, like, you told the cops you were the last person in the car.
At that point, why wouldn't you be like, oh my god, I heard a loud noise, someone must have broken it, I don't know, something.
Yeah, like, yeah, I don't know. Brad did share that he knew Tammy was seeing someone else, but he didn't know what the man's name was, and so the detectives were like, kind of like, why didn't you ask her who it was? And he just was like, I didn't want to know, I just didn't want to know. He said, he was like, no, we were working on things. We're going to get back together. We're working on our marriage. So the detectives kept questioning Brad, and he stated that they needed to find his wife and that they had the wrong guy when they were thinking it was him, and that he did hope that they found her body because that would prove that he didn't do it. After 5 hours of questioning, Brad finally asked for a lawyer. And that's when the police ended up arresting him for first-degree murder. They didn't have the body or anything. All they really had was missing. They did test the blood, and it was hers.
He doesn't seem to care for someone who was working on his marriage with his wife. He doesn't seem overly concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, too, because if they just found blood, why wouldn't you say, maybe she's hurt somewhere, let's find her? No, you just hope they find her body so you can be proven innocent, not that she's okay or there's something that can be done about it, or
you can actually, this was covered on ID on a TV show called The Devil Speaks. It's season 1, episode 3 that they do this case, and you actually do see his interrogation, so you can see the video. And
just kind of like whatever about it.
Yeah, he's just kind of sitting back, kind of leaning back on his chair. He doesn't seem like overly upset, I would say. I mean, this is just my takeaway from it. He seems pretty calm. It's not like he's freaking out that his wife is missing and that her blood was found. He just is kind of like, no, it wasn't me. You know, I know you guys will find the right guy. As soon as you find the body, you'll find out it wasn't me. And the police noted that he wasn't acting like somebody that would be upset.
Yeah.
Somebody, if their wife is actually missing, like how you would react. So they were just kind of like, no, I'm pretty sure we got the right guy. So within 12 hours of her being reported missing, they had arrested someone, but the police weren't sure if they had the right guy. After all, there were two suspects, Brad and Tammy's boyfriend, Brian.
Yeah.
And you're going to look at who's closest to her and who has the most motive. And so those two would have the most motive. And Brian is actually also married with children.
Oh, Brian.
Yes. Tammy's not the only one being unfaithful in this situation.
Okay.
And he
also, I feel though, yes, there might be some like motive on Brian's part, but then why would he report her
missing?
Missing. Especially if you've perfectly framed Brad. Why would you? I don't know. I just.
Yeah.
I'm hoping for the best here, Brian. Don't let me down.
So So the cops still needed to locate Tammy. So the town mobilized and search parties went out, and right before the sun went down, the helicopter spotted her body out in a field. Tammy had been stabbed over 48 times. She had defensive wounds on her hands, like she had tried to grab the knife and it had sliced her hand to the bone. She had been left totally naked, face up in a field of dirt and grass. So very personal.
That's degrading. That's overkill. You're trying to degrade her. Ooh, all the fingers are pointing at Brad more and more.
More and more. Just kind of checking the boxes here. But Brad was sure that they would find evidence that would prove he didn't do it on her body. But the police actually didn't find any evidence that pointed to anyone. There was no evidence, no DNA found, nothing. Police couldn't even locate where she had been murdered. She hadn't been murdered in the field. There wasn't enough blood. There was blood in the car.
Then she had to have been transported from somewhere else, but there was nothing found in the house either.
So they did know that she had been transported in her car because they did find more blood of her blood in the car. You can see pictures of it and it's all over. But not enough for her death to have occurred there, but
her just like someone put her in there and took her to that place.
There was no sign that she had been murdered in the house, so they checked every room to see if there was blood. They checked Brad and Tammy's bedroom. The bed was made. There was no blood in the bed, none in Brad and Tammy's bedroom. There was just no evidence of anything, like any altercation, nothing having happened in the house. Brian, however, had also been eliminated as a suspect, as he actually had an alibi for that night. He really didn't want them to because his wife didn't know he was having an affair with somebody else, but his alibi was his wife, so they had to go also, and talk to her.
I mean, your wife needs to know because you guys either need to work on your marriage or end it, and it's better than going down for murder.
Yeah, and it was really interesting because one of the police detectives that was interviewed was like, you know, his wife, we share that he's been unfaithful to her. So she's mad and upset and hurt. So this would have been a total perfect time for her to be like, no, he wasn't with me. That's what the policeman said.
I mean,
hey, true that.
Yeah, but props to her for being, okay, you'll get yours, but it's not going to be right now. Like, I'm not going to let you go down for a murder you didn't commit. But we're going to deal with this later.
Yeah. So his wife actually shared that he had been home with her all night. So nice on her part.
And so proving that she deserves better than Brian.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
She got someone who wouldn't cheat on her.
Yeah.
Whatever Brian's wife is, I hope you're doing well out there.
Yeah. So the police still thought that they had arrested the right guy. Then out of nowhere, four letters showed up addressed to the police on the case as well as the prosecutors. They stated that they were from a cousin of Brian's and that he had shared with him that he had killed Tammy. The letters had a lot of detail about Brian and Tammy as well as the murder. So like where Brian and Tammy would have their trysts, what hotel they would go to, just a lot of really personal information about their business. And then, a lot of details about the murders. One detail in particular stated that there had been a condom left inside of Tammy.
Damn. Yeah.
So during her autopsy, a condom hadn't been found, but the police wanted to make sure. So they had Tammy's body re-examined. And lo and behold, there was a condom left in her rectum. Obviously, the killer would be the only one who would know that.
Yeah.
The only problem was that the condom, since it had been left inside of Tammy so long, there was no usable DNA located on it. So the police started to look at Brian again. The question was, if only the details that the killer would know were male, there's two suspects. So they're like, okay, maybe Brian's wife is lying or she was asleep and he snuck out. We're kind of like the scenarios they were playing, or somehow Brad's getting some information out. But the problem is that all of Brad's letters, because he's in jail, were being monitored. So they knew Brad had not mailed a letter out. But they did know that Brad had visitors. And the day before the letters were sent out, Brad had a visit from his twin brother, Brett.
Brett.
His twin brother's name Brad and Brian.
Brad,
So we got three B's in this case. So oh my goodness. During this visit, Brad had brought along a notepad and a pencil. And when police looked in Brett's car, they found the notepad and saw that it matched what was sent to them because he had kind of samples.
Sample letters?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And then there's video.
This is like JonBenet Ramsey when her mom had sample.
Oh, yes, totally.
Okay, not her mom. The killer has sample ransom notes thrown in the trash.
Yeah, but it was her note. Yeah, but it was her notepad.
It was her notepad
and her handwriting. But okay, whatever.
Okay, Brett.
Yeah, so real smart, Brett. And they also had video of Brett in the visit showing Brad the sample to the like window to see if that's what he wanted him to write. So not the brightest people. Not the brightest
Check
ball.
Out but... the big brains on Brad. My God.
I know. If you remember, Brad had been sure that when the body was discovered that there would be evidence to show that he didn't do it. When they didn't locate the condom the first time, he had to point them in the right direction. And the letter was meant to do that. Police think that Brad actually followed Tammy and Brian around. And when they had sex in Brian's car, he had actually tossed out a condom out the window, and they believe Brad picked it up.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
First, please don't throw condoms out of the window if you're no. having an affair and
that's disgusting.
Oh, that's nasty.
Put it in Second a Kleenex ball. And then throw it in the garbage can.
Throw it in a little trash can in your car and dispose of it later. Drive somewhere and toss it in a dumpster. I don't give a fuck. But don't be letting animals eat that nasty thing. Second of all, ew, he picked up a used condom.
He really was trying to, point everything at Brian here.
Oh my God.
So the police also finally located evidence in another field where they found bagged up bedding and a plastic tarp that was all covered in blood. This showed a lot of premeditation on Brad, obviously a ton of premeditation with the condom on Brad's part for the murder, because Brad, this is what they believe happened, that Brad laid out the tarp on their bed and then covered the tarp with a whole bunch of blankets so that it was like multiple layers of bedding on the bed the day of the murder. And then when Tammy went to bed, he ended up stabbing her. They think that there were five, because there was like five stab wounds, I believe, in the back and around the neck that had occurred. And they think that those stabbings had occurred while she was in the bed. And then she might have flipped around. I'm not sure, but
tried to protect herself.
Mm-hmm. And then thinking about all of this, this all happened with Haley in the home. So, yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound like she heard anything, so that's something to be thankful for.
Exactly. Yeah, very true. So, police thought that after he stabbed her, that he rolled her up in the bedding, and then when she was in the car, he actually stabbed her multiple times more, because remember, there was like almost 50 stab wounds, and if only five happened in the bed, that's like 40 plus happened in the car, which is probably accounts why there's so much blood in the car. And then he disposed of her body in the field. Police also discovered a tape recorder in Brad's dresser that taped a conversation of Tammy calling Brian. On the tape recorder, it has Brad practicing and pretending to be Tammy talking to Brian about their affair and Brad finding out. And then they think he put it in the car the day of the murder and then turned it on to record. And then he left flowers and a note inside of her car that day stating that he wanted to get back together and that he still loved her. And so he was hoping that that letter would make her call Brian. And so he would record that. And so she ended up calling Brian and using his full name. So he found out who he was and all that. That also shows some premeditation.
Yeah.
So prove that Brad actually did know who his wife was having an affair with, because he had told the cops that he didn't know, but this proved that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian wasn't the only one that Brad tried to point the finger at. There was him trying to set up Brian the whole time with the condom and all of that. During his trial, like right before all the trial started, really, Brad stated that it was actually his 12-year-old daughter, Haley, who had killed her mother. And that...
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That Brad and Tammy had told her that day that they were planning on getting a divorce and that Haley had gotten really upset and that he had come into their bedroom and found Haley stabbing Tammy. He said that she had been sleepwalking, so she didn't know that she was doing it, and that he was only guilty of really trying to protect his daughter by hiding the body.
Uh-huh. So the child stabbed her mom, cleaned herself up, or you did, and then she went to school like nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's your defense.
Yep. He is a total piece of shit. How dare you try to pin that on your daughter?
I know. What an asshole.
Yeah. So the jury didn't buy this story at all. And Brad was found guilty of first degree murder. I think I read that it only took like 3 hours of deliberation, and one of those hours was them getting lunch.
Nice.
So they're like, this is quick, open shut case. And yeah, they sentenced him to life in prison. Brad has appealed his case, but
of course he did.
Haley did share with Dateline NBC that this is what she remembers of that day and night. Her parents did tell her that they were planning on getting a divorce and that she was upset about it. But, you know, as any kid would be, that their parents were getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. But that she remembers, she woke up and her door had been closed, and it was weird because her door to her bedroom was never closed. And mm-hmm. then she ended up kind of waking up again when her dad opened the door to look in on her, and he had been carrying a whole bunch of laundry to be washed, which she thought was weird because it was like middle of the night.
Yeah.
2-3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And that she thought it was strange, but that he just told her it was okay. And he ended up laying down with her on the bed until she fell asleep. And then Haley remembers that morning, her dad told her that her mom had left with her boyfriend and that she wouldn't be back for a few days, which kind of took Haley by surprise because she didn't know her mom had a boyfriend, but that's what her dad shared with her that day. And not to share it with their family or anybody else because it was their personal business and not others. So Haley was shocked when her father turned on her, obviously, and had stated that she killed her mom, when obviously she didn't. Haley has not talked with her dad since the trial and doesn't ever want to talk to him or have contact with him ever again. Haley actually ended up being raised by her grandparents back in Lander, Wyoming. So, and now she's an adult and she has a kid of her own, and she keeps in contact with the detective. I think the saddest thing on the ID show that I watched was that there is a recording of the police detective telling Haley that her mom's body has been found. And that just was so heart-wrenching and just so upsetting to think. I mean, she really lost both parents because there's no coming back from that. And there was no reason really for Brad to have killed Tammy. But I mean, that goes to show, because even though there wasn't physical violence, or, you know, like, she wasn't being physically abused by Brad that anybody knows of or that was stated. I mean, maybe behind closed doors, we don't know what was happening. But when I started sharing this, like, you were like, red flags when I told you that he was very, very clingy and kind of controlling in that way.
I would say almost like emotional. I don't even know if that would count as emotional abuse, but just
controlling.
You can't trust that person. And I don't know, because that would be, relationships are built on trust. If you can't trust that the person can hang out without you or be around their family members or their friends without you being right there, then you have serious issues in your relationship then that you've got to work on. Because like you said, I mean, at first it's nice that they want to spend all of their time with you, but the longer that goes on,
And it's like, I mean, maybe he just really likes to be around her. And I mean, maybe some people are like that, but there are just some red flags and like some things that, you know, check in on your friends and family if they are in relationships where you just feel like something's not quite right.
Always trust your gut. If something's wrong, I mean, what, worst case scenario, it turns out to be something and you've stepped in and now you can help, or mm-hmm. what, your friend is like, no, everything's good and we're cool, or it turns out that there is nothing wrong. Okay, but at least you checked in on your friend to see what's going on.
So that is the murder of Tammy Rhea and her terrible husband, Brad.
Yeah, stupid Brad.
Stupid Brad.
God. Ugh,
I know.
What an asshole.
I know, what an asshole. So, I mean, just the twists and turns on that case, when I was reading about it, because you're like, okay, like, husband did it. And then you're like, wait, what? A twin brother? And then, like,
twin brother to go along with trying to frame the boyfriend. I don't know.
That's his twin brother did get charged and did spend some time in jail for that. I didn't mention that. So he had some consequences.
Good. Oh my God. Well,
yeah, the twin brother and then the trying to pin it on the daughter. Like, geez, this guy.
Hopefully he's not thriving in prison like the other prisoners we've talked about in the past couple episodes. I didn't
read to see what he was doing since then. His daughter is doing well.
Good. She deserves to be doing well.
Yep.
Brian's wife. I hope she's doing good too.
Yeah, I didn't read to see what happened or if they stayed married. I'm a person that leans towards once a cheater, always a cheater. And if you get cheated on, dump the piece of shit that cheated on you.
There you go.
My advice. From my cynical self.
Also too, though, like, I don't know, even if whatever happened, like, even if she did decide to stay, hopefully they went through counseling.
And
how to get through, I don't know. She deserves a lot if they stay together, even if they did. She deserves a really good husband, especially because she was not petty and was not like, I don't know.
Yeah, she's
probably with his girlfriend. Good job.
Yeah. Way to go, Brian's wife.
Yeah.
Being the bigger person.
Good wishes to you. Hopefully you're doing. So my story is kind of short today, but I did want to talk about it. I thought it was a very interesting tale, even though there wasn't a whole lot. So my case takes place in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And this case was actually only the second homicide in this small city and ended up being only one of a handful of cold cases around this. So it's a pretty unique case that happened. February 28th, 1981, Lee Litz was driving a Jeep. He was test driving a car along Sycamore Avenue in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. When he was driving down the road, he spotted what looked like maybe a wine bottle that had broken. Like, there was just a bunch of red on the snow because it's in February, so it's snow, a lot of snow and ice. And then it ended in like this a big bundle of blankets. So he pulled over to the side of the road to look, and he found a baby in the bundle with tears frozen on his cheeks.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, so he called the police, and when they arrived on scene, it was too late and the baby was pronounced dead. So the coroner estimated that the baby had been there around 24 hours or so and had only lived for maybe 2 or 3 of those hours outside. Mm. It was a baby boy, and he appeared to have been born healthy and almost full term. And his umbilical cord was still attached, and the coroner cited blood loss as well as the cold as his cause of death.
Okay.
Police began scouring local hospitals. They were questioning doctors, midwives, all kinds of stuff, hoping someone would know about a woman who gave birth or was close to giving birth, but they had no luck there. And even to some of the cops spoke to interviewers there and said, due to confidentiality rules between doctors and patients, they thought it would be unlikely that if this woman had a doctor anyway, then they wouldn't have come forward because they kind of can't. Although, I don't know, because you have confidentiality, but
that's murder.
Yeah. In terms of murder, I feel like you can't, but maybe it's confidentiality and they can't be like, oh, these are my patients who...
Oh, like who are pregnant.
They don't know, right? Also, too, if the umbilical cord is still attached, and they also mentioned, too, that the, what is it? Is the placenta that comes out as well? All of that was still
So there. this baby was not born in a hospital.
No, that's why I'm like, if it was born in a hospital, it was not a very good one because none of that would have been around. So a woman in the community offered to pay for a proper funeral for the child. She named him Andrew John Doe, so he would at least have a name that wasn't just John Doe.
Okay.
And a week later, people gathered to offer condolences and say goodbye to baby Andrew. They brought stuffed animals and even had pinned a note to his little yellow pajamas that they buried him in that said, "You are loved." And they placed all of the stuffed animals and everything near his casket, and they would end up being buried with him as well. And it was probably about like 50 or so people. I didn't look up how big the town was at the time, but I mean, a lot of people showed up to show their support, including the man who found him. He felt like he had this connection.
This connection. Yeah, absolutely.
So police searched the crowd, hoping to spot Andrew's parents, but again, fell short because for anyone who knows, sometimes the police will stake out funerals or memorials or things like that when they don't know who caused the crime, because generally the people who commit crimes will return or insert themselves in some way.
Yeah, so kind of like my North Dakota case where he all acted all weird at the funeral and showed up at the house.
Yeah, so, but they couldn't find anybody that fit that. So since DNA technology was pretty much non-existent at the time, and I looked it up, since this was in 1981, actually the first case that used DNA evidence as part of the trial wasn't until like 1987, so...
That was in England, right?
Somewhere, I didn't look at where. It was just later on. So
late
80s. So we were short by a few years. And even then, a smaller town in the Midwest isn't going to have the technology right when it happens. It's going to be more towards like bigger cities and more populated states. Andrew had been left for 24 hours before he was found. So the police didn't really have much to go on. They reached out to tip lines, but those led to nothing as well. Every tip they investigated either led to women that were still pregnant or women who answered the door with babies in their arms, which means they had theirs. The case would remain cold for years, and baby Andrew would see no justice. But in 2009, police exhumed Andrew's body to extract DNA from his bones and tissue. So at this point, we're like way after this case has been cold, but now the technology is starting to come up. So I had a couple things that did two different years. Some people say it didn't happen till like later in like 2016, but I saw a few articles that listed 2009. So that was the one I'm going to go through because I saw more than one article that said it. So after having no matches in the South Dakota DNA database, they hit another wall from this DNA that they retrieved. In 2013, however, another case in South Dakota would give law enforcement some hope. Skeletal remains were found in a car near Elk Point, and the police tasked with identifying them had outsourced the DNA work to a lab in Texas where they had the technology to extract that DNA, and they ended up identifying that those skeletal remains belonged to two missing girls from a cold case in 1971. So this got the police thinking, okay, maybe this lab in Texas might be able to help us in ways that we haven't really been able to or using a database that might help. So Sioux Falls police then made the decision to send Andrew's remains to hopefully shed some light on what happened all those years ago. Just like we mentioned in Angie Dodge's case, which I believe was Idaho, and the well-known case of the Golden State Killer, police used DNA to start building a family tree. Now, I kept looking for how they connected it to this. The only thing I could find was it was connected to like a third cousin and they started building off of that. But that was only in one article and I'm not really sure. It just said a lot of articles were like, oh, they started building a family tree off of this DNA. So they were looking at birth records and marriage licenses and residence. And eventually they would be led to a family in Sioux Falls. And so they had been living in that town the entire time and were still living in that town. Teresa Bentas, I'm going to pronounce it Bentas, B-N-T-A-A-S. Not really sure if there's a different pronunciation for that.
That's how I think I would say it too.
Yeah. So Teresa Bentas, who at the time was then Teresa Jostin, was only 19 when she was pregnant. She hid it from family, friends, and even baby Andrew's father. She had Andrew alone in her apartment, then drove him to the ditch where she set him down and drove away. On the day of Andrew's funeral, she claimed that she was in denial that that was her child, and she didn't attend. So she just straight up was like, nope, can't be my kid. Although, I'd be interested to know, what did she think happened? Because it sounds like she left him on a pretty, I don't know too much about the road. It didn't sound like, normally when you test drive a car, they're not sending you out on like main roads. You go on things, you'd be able to pick up speed or test it a little more. So it didn't seem like it was that populated of a place. I don't know why you'd leave the baby there. Even in the 80s, you would think to leave the baby at a hospital or a fire station or somewhere, if that was your intention of to like get the baby adopted or something. I don't know. They didn't really go into what she thought would happen. She just adamantly was like, that's not my child, and just didn't go to the funeral, didn't pay attention. So 5 years after that, her and Andrew's father got married. They never gave me his name, and ended up having two children. Police obtained a warrant to search for her DNA, which they found on beer cans and cigarette butts in her trash. They also found the DNA from males who were also connected to baby Andrew. So there was a lot of familial connections here, which would make sense. If she is the mom, then, and he is the dad, then those kids would also share the same DNA. So in 2019, on what would have been Andrew's 38th birthday, police arrived to the Bentas residence to arrest Teresa after finding the DNA to be a match. Bentas' husband was not charged after police learned that he had no idea about his true firstborn. In February, in February of 2020, Bentas' lawyers were arguing to get the DNA thrown out, stating that it violated her Fourth Amendment rights. And for anyone who needs to know, the Fourth Amendment protects you from unlawful searches and seizures. So basically, if the police don't have probable cause, they can't just go and start taking stuff. But the police had warrants to collect this DNA. They were just trying to make the argument that connecting, this was a loosely connected DNA. They just built this thing, and so there was no probable cause. They just picked her, and it wasn't until they got the DNA that they knew anything. So they were just kind of basically saying the police were kind of just going on a wild
goose chase.
And they were just like, oh, let's do this. Also funny to know is that they found the DNA on cigarette butts and beer cans, which was also how Angie Dodge's killer was found, because he threw out a cigarette butt.
Yeah.
So moral of the story is, please stop smoking. You're going to get your DNA. But in March of 2020, a judge deemed that she had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the items that were searched, because they all came from her trash. Yep. And so the evidence was admissible. Benitas posted bond after she was arrested in 2019 and has been out of custody since May of that year. She has to wear an ankle GPS monitor. She has to always stay with a family member, and she has to check in with her attorney at their office once a week. Her trial was scheduled for April 2020, but since the coronavirus happened, I don't know what South Dakota's
South Dakota has not shut down at all.
I tried to find anything that gave me an update, and that was the last update I had, was that she was out on bail, and the judge had decided that the evidence was admissible, which sounds like it's pretty, I mean, pretty damning evidence that you did something, and especially because she did also say, like, she confessed, so that wasn't the only thing they had. And I know that case was super short, because there wasn't, I mean, aside from leaving him in the cold, it wasn't like there was ongoing abuse or anything.
No.
It didn't go deeply into her family or what the
situation obviously was. There's something going on with her mental health. Like, you know, just.
And I'd be interested to know, because it didn't say anything, because her other children were adults at that point, because they would have been at, I mean, depending on if they had kids right after they got married, they would at least be, what, 33?
Under.
But it said they were both adults, so they're somewhere in that age. But I would be interested to know kind of what they thought or how their childhood was. Because if you planned on marrying this person, it didn't happen for 5 years, but what was the fear, I guess? Because also, too, she was 19. She wasn't, like a teenager. Like, I mean, I guess 19 is still a teenager, but she wasn't like 16 years old or underage having a child. She was an adult at that point, you know?
Yeah, but still unmarried women. Just, I mean, even, I mean, I lived in Nebraska and, you know, was, I don't know how much older than her, but 19 years older. Yeah, okay, so I'm 18 years older or younger than she is. Like, there's still a lot of, there was, I don't know about now, but a lot of stigma in the, you know, it's a very conservative area. Unwed mothers were very still frowned upon when I was in high school and very judged and, mm-hmm. you know, so, I mean, that could play a part in it. Who knows?
Yeah. But then too, again, you had the foresight to also like hide your pregnancy for that long rather than, I mean, and I get it, probably in the 80s, resources were limited as far as like what you could do to terminate a pregnancy, yeah. an unwanted pregnancy, but you're going through all of this stuff to hide it.
Yeah.
And you had the baby. You could have easily wrapped him up in the blanket just the same and dropped him off, like I said, at a fire station in a grocery store. Yeah,
but that was still abandonment back then. Like, she could still get in trouble for that. You couldn't, because safe haven laws weren't around then. I remember in Nebraska, safe haven laws didn't happen until I was, I think, in high school, because there was a huge to-do with it, because they didn't put an age limit on the safe haven. And so people were dropping off like kids, not babies, at fire stations in Nebraska. So I'm guessing safe haven laws probably happened about the same time, if they have them. I'm guessing they probably do in South Dakota.
Yeah, I think most places have them.
Yeah, but I don't think they existed in the 80s. So, I mean, you could still do adoption and stuff, but you couldn't just leave your baby at a fire station with no questions asked.
Yeah, but also if she had no problem leaving the baby outside, the baby outside in front of a fire station where they maybe couldn't connect it to, because again, they still don't have DNA, they still don't know.
Yeah, they wouldn't find out who it is. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
I know, even if they do, abandonment charges are way better than a murder charge for killing your child. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just feel like I get it, the panic of it, but also that poor baby was crying in the cold hours.
Oh, that's so terrible.
And she cared enough to wrap it in blankets. Then you think, again, this dude had no idea until he saw it from a distance. I don't know. It just, to me, there seemed to be so many other things that you could have done.
I'm amazed that he's noticed and stopped. Like,
well, it was because of the trail that he thought something had broken, because the snow was red.
So
maybe something had broken, or maybe it was blood. He said it looked like almost like a bottle of wine had been broken, because it just dragged. And so almost like someone poured it out. So he just went, and then he noticed the bundle and went to look, thankfully pulled over, good Samaritan. And so after,
I couldn't imagine being him though. And that's what you find. Oh gosh.
Yeah. And so after Teresa was arrested, the detectives who were working on the case did go leave some stuffed animals at baby Andrew's gravesite, just to kind of say like they did it. They helped find justice for him, even if it was 38 years later and then and some change. I mean, got justice, hopefully. I mean, and again, we go back to this conversation that I think we had with the Angie Dodge thing of the use of this familial DNA, and that was a lot that was brought up, and kind of why I wanted to do this story despite it being very short.
Yeah.
Is kind of the ethics of it. And I understand, like, in some situations like this, we ended up finding the person who did this. But remember back to when we talked about Angie Dodge, it almost pegged the wrong guy.
Yeah.
Because of some weird branch of family history.
Yeah.
And then too, bringing up the idea that the government has access to our DNA and that kind of stuff, and that what they can use it for. And right now it seems, I mean, we're finding killers and solving crimes, but at what point is it becoming something that could be used possibly against us? And I'm not trying to go all conspiracy theory on anybody.
No.
I'm just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on like that use of familial DNA and what you think.
I think this is a part where technology and science has far surpassed what our legal system really understands. And mm-hmm. so it definitely, I know we're trying to catch up quickly. And so a lot, I know a lot of the ancestry, you have to now opt in. So you have to opt into GEDmatch to have your DNA being available to, you know, crime labs and stuff. But I struggle.
Yeah.
Because it is sort of an invasion of privacy, but I wouldn't have a problem with them having my DNA just because I don't foresee myself doing anything where my DNA would be in trouble.
Yeah. But then you're also, again, it's connecting to a certain point. So again, going back to the Angie, it almost pegged the wrong guy because it was close enough, even though
there's
this whole other branch. So I think we have to work on putting laws in place, because again, technology has now surpassed what legal things, in the same way they had to adjust the laws for things like cell phone and pictures, and because they know they adjusted certain things for, I guess, sexting and things like that. And where does that fall in terms of things like child pornography and just basic pornography and things like that? The laws had to adjust, and it did take a while, if I remember it, and it's still probably in some places taking a while. So I think we need to look at the technology and coming up with the laws that can match up to it to protect us, but also still be able to use this to catch, because I mean, the Golden State Killer was caught with this kind of stuff, which was incredible. Yes. And again, we were able to find Angie Dodge's killer, and her mom was able to get that answer, and she was able to get justice. And in this case, baby Andrew was able to get justice that his mom didn't get away with murder. And again, she has mental health issues, and there's things that we have to look into, but also other options available, and she needs to be held responsible for leaving her baby on the side of a road to die.
Yeah. And like with the Angie Dodge case, like close enough DNA, like you wouldn't get away with that. Like, oh, it's close enough. I mean, it's part of his family. I think it needs to, like, if you have it, like lead you in the right direction of like what family member it could possibly come from. So I know there are times when they'll be like, it's a sibling of this person. So here are your choices. And then if you can match it to that, then okay. But no, if it's just like, oh, this is your side of the family, then it's like, that's not close enough. And hopefully you have enough DNA where you can then DNA it and prove or disprove if that person's done it. If you can't, then I think there needs to be other evidence used. Although I think people are just now like really looking for, when, you know, juries are probably looking for DNA or some scientific thing to really prove cases.
Yeah, it definitely has come a long way in terms of helping solve crimes and stuff like that. So yeah, just something to think about. And I wanted to share that story because when I read it, I know it was very short, but it was still heartbreaking. And
absolutely.
And just the fact that these police officer, I know last week my story was about police officers not really doing the right thing, but this one was more about their dedication to these cold cases, and the fact that these cases really stayed with them and that they never gave up hope, like 38 years later, and they finally got justice for him. And that's a really, really honorable thing. And I was very happy to hear that that was the, or we're getting closer to the conclusion of this.
Yeah. And just thinking of how many cases could be solved and have these kind of answers just based off of that, so that they don't. And I know there isn't funding and there aren't always cold case availability, you know, is like, I know a lot of detectives have to do it kind of on their own time or in between things. And so just props to anybody who does finally solve a cold case.
Yeah. Cause those detectives were checking up I want to say it was like every year or every 10 years or so, every couple of years they were checking to make sure, like, okay, did we find any matches? Is there any DNA coming up?
Especially older cases, because there weren't even those options back then. I mean, a lot of times on this murder cases, they could be like, that we can identify that that's semen, but that's it, you know? Yeah. And it's like, okay, so now we can do so much more. So that's what science has done. So that's good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for telling the story of baby Andrew and sharing that.
All right. So now it's time for our super fun state facts.
And cities.
All right. Are we starting with city facts or state facts today?
Well, whatever. You know, we just kind of fly by the seat of our pants.
Yeah, I can go ahead and start with my city fact.
Okay.
So my case took place in Sioux Falls. And so an interesting fact that I found was the first four-door automobile was invented in Sioux Falls. And it was invented by a man named Thomas Fawick. Not entirely sure, but I'm going to say
we're great Fawick. With the names.
Yeah. Thomas Fawick invented the aluminum Fawick flyer in his auto shop in 1908. President Teddy Roosevelt, who frequented South Dakota to hunt bison, and famed U.S. Marshal Seth Bullock rode a Fawick flyer together in a 1910 parade through Sioux Falls. Actually, was Teddy Roosevelt president then?
When was what time? Was? What date?
1908 or 1910?
He had two terms. He was president, like, because McKinley died and he was his vice president, so he was in 1900, and then he got reelected later, so like he could have been
1901 to 1909. I looked it up. Had just finished being president.
I was
close. It was interesting in this article where I got the information. It didn't call him president. You know how they still call him president? Anyway, so they rode a Fawick flyer together in 1910 in a parade in Sioux Falls. And Fawick himself actually went on to create a bunch of other inventions, including a hand grip for golf clubs and the Airflex clutch, which was first used by World War II naval landing crafts. And this guy, he just did a lot of cool things in Sioux Falls. He even brought the statue of David, like a bronze casting of the statue of David from Michelangelo's David. Mm-hmm. And he put it into Fawick Park near the Big Sioux River.
Oh.
So he donated the statue to the city in the 1970s.
Classing up the place.
Yeah, so that's also something fun fact about Sioux Falls. You can go see one of only a few bronze castings of the original David.
So, and then if anybody watches the TV, or not watches, because it was a long time ago, the TV show Deadwood, Seth Bullock is featured in that. So, you know, he was a U.S. Marshal, and then he was in Deadwood, and he actually owned a hotel in Deadwood, South Dakota. So I've actually been to Deadwood, South Dakota. I can put some pictures of my time up there. Like I told you, my 16th birthday was spent touring South Dakota and the Black Hills. So I'll add pictures of Deadwood. And so that's also where Wild Bill Hickok was murdered.
Oh,
so over a hand of poker. Oh. So in Calamity Jane, if you know, like her grave is there as well. And Belle Watlin, I think she was a well-known prostitute. She's buried there. Deadwood was quite the happening town in the 1800s. Like, so how exciting. We all know, I mean, we learned from Nevada that I love Old West history for us. But I did not know that about the four-door car being invented in Sioux Falls. Interesting. Okay. So, ready for my city fact. So, as I mentioned, my city for this week is Pierre, South Dakota. And in Pierre, South Dakota, on the Capitol grounds, is the Flaming Fountain. So, this was a memorial was built for a memorial for veterans, which is kind of fitting since I'm talking about this and we're recording on our Memorial Day. So the Flaming Fountain, the interesting thing about it is that it's a fountain that has water, but also due to the natural gases, it burns. So there is a flame on top. I'll link a picture on our blog so everybody can see it. So on Capitol Lake, I guess, I don't know, they gave it the name Eternal Flame due to, for decades, it continued to burn a pretty big flame. I saw a video of it. It's pretty impressive, and it's just because of the natural gas that the water has. So who knew water could burn? But in 2016, it actually ended up burning out. And so people were really sad about it. But all of a sudden, now it is burning again. So if anybody wants to go
take it out before it turns off again.
Yeah, before. But it burned for decades. So I think that's interesting. Cool. And the water from the fountain is hot. So it comes out at like 96 degrees.
Oh, damn.
Because of, I'm guessing, the natural. It's kind of like geyser, whatever you call those stinky springs. I don't. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it smells like sulfur. Like
sulfur.
Like, yeah. Because then that wouldn't be great because that stinks. So
oh, cool. That's an interesting fact.
Yeah. So I'll put a picture. We'll have a lot of pictures on our blog for this week.
Yeah. So go check it out.
Random. And then I have the state fact for this week. So South Dakota is actually home of the largest motorcycle rally in the world. I don't know if anybody's heard of it, but it's called, it's called Sturgis. It actually started in 1938 when they just liked the drive because it's a really nice drive when you go there. And so I think it's just a pretty long drive that they just kind of took. So the Indian motorcycle riders decided that they were going, and I guess it was called the Jack Pine Gypsies Motorcycle Club, do a hill climb. And so they traveled to Sturgis. And now, like, it is huge. So in my infamous 16, when I turned 16, my birthday is in the first week of August. And that's always when Sturgis happens, is the first, it starts the first Friday of August, and it goes for 10 days. And when I'm talking, like, large amounts, like, 500,000 motorcyclists come to this. It is insane. Like, just absolutely insane how many motorcycles. So when we traveled up through the Black Hills, Sturgis was going on, and, like, you would go to any town and there would be tens of thousands of motorcycles just lining the streets. And very interesting people, some very nice people, some kind of rude people. But yeah, just this huge motorcycle rally that happens once a year. I don't know if it's happening this year because of COVID, but so this might be the first year that it gets missed. I guess not the first year. So there were some exceptions during World War II. So in 1942, there were gasoline rations, so people couldn't make the trip because they didn't have any gas to drive up there. But yeah, it's just like they hang out. Like all these motorcycle guys just kind of hang out, and girls.
That's so cool.
But yeah, so I actually have a picture. I'll post of that because we took pictures of all of the motorcycles. Actually in Deadwood, so when they're traveling, so they take days and they just kind of slowly meander through the Black Hills to get to Sturgis. So it's really interesting. It's kind of a fun thing. So if you ever have the opportunity to travel, well, this year it's supposed to happen starting August 7th through the 16th. The highest attendance ever was in 2015 when there was 739,000 people that attended.
Oh god, that's crazy.
And I think Sturgis is a really small, like, let me see how big Sturgis population is.
Yes, they probably make bank in tourism for that week.
Oh, heck yeah.
That's crazy.
So Sturgis's population is 6,943 people.
Oh my God.
Can you imagine having like 750,000 people all of a sudden come to your town that's normally 7,000?
10 days? Oh my God.
That would be my nightmare. But yeah, so go check it out if you want to at Sturgis.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you for that. That's cool.
Yeah.
But like Amber said, we are posting some pictures on the blog this week. So go check it out. And you can check out the blog after every episode. We always have some more details on the case if you want to know more about it before you listen. And we have some like fun extra facts in some of them. So check us out at www.stateofmurder.com. Make sure to like and follow us at SOM Podcast on Facebook and on Instagram. You can pretty much listen to us wherever, so let all your friends know. They can listen to us on basically any app that they use to listen to podcasts. If you do listen on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. Let us know what you like about it. And so that way it'll help other people find our podcast as well who might not hear about us. And
if you ever have any recommendations for lesser known crimes in states that we're hitting next, so we're going to Nebraska next week, my hometown. I don't need any. I already know what case I'm doing. And my dad, so we've gotten our first case of somebody recommending a case. So my dad has recommended a case for Selena to cover.
So if you have other cases or fun facts or anything about states we have coming up, please email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear from you guys and let us know what you think. Just say hi, give us some recommendations. If you have any corrections on anything we've talked about in the past or now, again, feel free, let us know. We like to hear from you guys.
Oh, and then I'll have a correction, because I don't think when I told you guys the fun fact for Montana about the biggest gold nugget being found there in the world, apparently that was a lie. So that website lied to us, because I talked to my dad, the gold guru, He's like, no, Australia, it's the largest gold nugget was found in Australia.
Sorry, like, Australia, we didn't give you credit where credit is.
So I was like, oh, okay, so I thought I'd mention that in our podcast, because I was like, oh, well then, I don't know why they're called the treasure state.
I don't know. Cool. If you know why Montana is called the treasure state, email us. Let us know.
It's a treasure because Brad Pitt's movies take place there. We've learned.
So thank you guys for listening. We will see you next week when we hit Nebraska.
All right.